Coming up is the news.
Senior Iranian security official says that Tehran is determined to stop U.S. terrorist and counter-security actions in the region. Moscow slaps tit for tat sanctions on several EU officials for their accusation of the poisoning of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Germany reports more than 730 new COVID-related deaths in one day, while the number of confirmed cases there increasing by more than 19,500. Top story, the Iranian foreign minister is saying that a comprehensive diplomatic solution which involves all Afghan groups is the best guarantee for sustainable peace in Afghanistan. Mohammad Javad Zarif made a comment in a meeting with the Afghan president's national security advisor, Hamdullah Mohib, in Tehran. The top Iranian diplomat described support for Afghanistan as Tehran's principal policy and called for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Mohib hailed Iran's support for the Kabul government and nation and urged enhanced political, economic, cultural, and security ties. Mohib has also met with the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council. Ali Shamkhani stressed Iran's resolve to stop terrorist and destabilizing acts by the U.S. and its agents in the region and force them out of it. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has slammed the European signatories for breaching their commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. A short while ago, my colleague has discussed that issue in detail with our guests in our news review program.
Welcome. Iran's foreign minister says the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal have gravely breached their commitments under the accord. Mohammad Javad Zarif made the criticism in a tweet following a virtual meeting with foreign ministers of the remaining signatories to the deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Zarif said Britain, France and Germany should share the blame with the US for what he called irreparable harm to Iranians. He added that the trio have a last chance to save the pact, which he reiterated was not renegotiable. During the Monday meeting, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov demanded Washington return to the deal without any preconditions, a call also echoed by China's top diplomat.
The United States should return to the Iran nuclear deal unconditionally as soon as possible. It should also lift the sanctions against Iran, third-party entities, as well as individuals. And on this basis, Iran should fully resume its nuclear commitments.
At the end of the meeting, all the remaining parties to the JCPOA issued a statement reiterating their deep regret over the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the deal. They also once again called for preserving the agreement. They said U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231 that endorsed the accord remains fully in force. Joining us is Keith Preston, independent journalist and researcher, and we also have Daniel Lazar, author and journalist. Gentlemen, welcome. Keith, starting with you, so Tehran saying that the E3 and the EU essentially have gravely breached their obligations under the nuclear deal. What do you make of that statement?
Well, I think we have to look at it from the perspective of who is pulling their strings. We have to understand that the Western European states, the NATO member countries, are largely colonies of the United States. Now, that may be a somewhat hyperbolic statement, but only a slight one, because the European states are heavily dependent on the United States for their military defense. Also, in recent years, under the Trump administration, Washington has been squeezing the European states to contribute more to NATO as well. So we have to understand that the European states are under tremendous pressure from the United States to follow America's foreign policy line on every issue, including the relationship between the United States and Iran, even as the United States is actually pulling away from its European allies and strengthening its relationship with its allies in the Gulf states and in the Middle East and in North Africa. So we really can't understand anything that the Europeans are doing without first looking at what the Americans are doing. And the Trump administration has been very aggressive about first attempting to, abrogating the nuclear agreement that was put together under the Obama administration, and also escalating hostilities between the United States and Iran. The Soleimani assassination was one of the more prominent examples, but there have been many others. If we want to look at what's going on in Europe, we really have to look to America, because America pulls Europe's strings.
Daniel, Russia and China are urging the United States to return to the deal with no conditions. Do you see that happening?
I really don't. I think that Biden is under intense pressure to attach conditions to the negotiations before he re-enters the JCPOA. Saudi Arabia and Israel are both pushing for that very strongly, so I think he'll do it. And I think, therefore, that will probably doom the negotiations, because Iran will never go along with it.
And Daniel, do you understand perhaps Iran's stance here, that there's many in Iran that say it's America saying it's not the best deal, or Trump has described it as the worst deal in the world. There's many in Iran that also say it's not the best deal, in the sense that Iran conceded too much from its part as well.
Well, I mean, Iran has every reason to be absolutely outraged at the way this whole thing has developed. I mean, the U.S. pulled out unilaterally. Iran was upholding its part of the deal. The U.S. pulled out unilaterally, slapped highly punitive economic sanctions on Iran. And the European countries, France, Germany, and the United Kingdom, absolutely did nothing to uphold their end of the bargain by continuing to trade with Iran. Instead, they allowed themselves to be deterred from trade by U.S. pressure, and the economic embargo on Iran was therefore all the more complete. This is totally outrageous. This treaty has been twisted around to Iran's disfavor, and I don't blame Iran at all for being furious over the outcome. Biden could make it up if he re-entered into the agreement without any preconditions, but I doubt he will do that, because, as I said before, he's under intense pressure from the Saudis, the UAE, Qatar, etc., and the Israelis. All want him to step up pressure on Iran and to try to use the JCPOA as a lever to force Iran to conform with U.S. foreign policy dictates. And I just doubt Iran will do it, because Iran knows that no matter what it does, the U.S. will increase its aggression, increase its pressure, nonstop.
Keith, do you see it that way as well? Do you think the deal is dead?
Well, I do think that Joe Biden may have some motivation to re-enter the deal, because he was part of the Obama administration, and he would probably like to reclaim that aspect of the legacy of the Obama administration. It's something certainly that he could use to promote himself politically by saying he was the fellow who re-entered the deal with Iran following Trump's abrogation of it. So there is that element to it, and there are certain aspects of his party and his voter base and so forth that might be sympathetic to his position. But I do agree with what the other speaker was saying, in the sense that Mr. Biden is under extreme pressure to not re-enter the deal, not only pressure from the Saudi lobby, then the Israeli lobby, and other lobbies, Middle Eastern lobbies that are influential in American politics, but also because of the fact that Mr. Biden's victory was dependent in part on the support that he got from elements within the Republican Party that largely defected from the Trump campaign and colonized the Democratic Party, so the forcing the Democratic Party essentially to move right on certain issues, and a primary issue is U.S.-Iran relations. So I do see Mr. Biden being under pressure from that end as well, and that's going to likely undermine his ability to re-enter the deal.
Interesting stuff, gentlemen. Thank you very much indeed. Let's thank our guests for their thoughts. Keith Preston, independent journalist and researcher, and Daniel Lazar, author and journalist. Thank you for staying tuned to this edition of The News Review.
Now, moving on, Russia has slapped sanctions on several European Union envoys, and that after the bloc imposed travel bans on Russian officials over the poisoning of opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Moscow says that blacklisted envoys will be denied entry to Russia in response to what it calls their government's confrontational actions. The Russian Foreign Ministry has summoned the ambassadors of Germany, Sweden, and France over the EU sanctions. The three countries host the labs that concluded Navalny was poisoned by the Russian government in August. Navalny has claimed that a Russian security officer was pranked into admitting his role in the poisoning. Moscow has denied all the allegations. President Putin says the European inquiry is a trick to attack top officials in his government. The number of confirmed coronavirus cases in Germany has increased by nearly 20,000 to reach 1.5 million. Data released by the Robert Koch Institute for Infectious Diseases show the German death toll also rose by 731 in one day to more than 27,000. The head of the institute says it's highly likely that a mutation of the coronavirus that has been found in Britain also exists in Germany. More than 10,000 deaths from the virus have been reported in the country within the first 3 weeks of December. That's the deadliest month since the outbreak of COVID-19 there. The country has failed to curb the rapid spread of the virus during the second wave, despite implementing a nationwide lockdown last week. International alarm has grown over a new coronavirus strain detected in Britain, with dozens of nations imposing travel bans. More than 40 countries across the world have blocked flights or travel links with the UK. That's in an effort to stop the spread of the new COVID version, already causing panic in Britain. Australia has become the first country to report cases of the new strain outside Britain. Scientists say that the variant is up to 70% more transmissible. However, there is no evidence it's more deadly. Experts say the current vaccine should still be effective against it. The World Health Organization has said that new strains are a normal part of the evolution of a pandemic.
The news was delivered Saturday that the southeast and east of England, including the capital London, were descending into Tier 4 COVID-19 restrictions. This was sparked by the discovery of a new variant of the virus that is up to 70% more transmittable.
Given the early evidence we have on this new variant of the virus, the potential risk it poses, it is with a very heavy heart, I must tell you, we cannot continue with Christmas as planned. In England, those living in Tier 4 areas should not mix with anyone outside their own household at Christmas, though support bubbles will remain in place for those at particular risk of loneliness or isolation.
After the announcement, chaos ensued as people scrambled to leave ahead of the midnight deadline. People bundled up presents and essentials and set out hoping to save their Christmas plans after England's chief medical officer Chris Whitty suggested they unpack.
I want to put some numbers out there because I think that helps to explain why I'm going to give the answer that I'm going to give. But my short answer would be, please unpack it at this stage.
Officials say that the ban on Tier 4 Christmas visits is unenforceable. And to make things worse, hundreds of flights were cancelled after the UK's closest allies cut transport with it due to fears about the new COVID-19 strain. The decision meant closing off the UK's most important artery with mainland Europe, a step British Transport Minister Grant Shapps said was surprising, especially as, according to him, the new strain is already in continental Europe.
We tend to be more aware of the variants faster. And there have been thousands of variants of coronavirus. It's just that the particular one that we've seen in Kent and London, the thing which has led to the Tier 4 lockdown, is a particularly virulent variant of the virus. So it means that it spreads more easily. We've detected that first, but We know already that the cases have been found in continental Europe and other countries.
The chaos hit just days before the United Kingdom was due to exit the EU's orbit with or without a trade deal. Brexit negotiators Michel Barnier and Lord Frost met in Brussels Sunday, but yet again, an agreement was not reached. In view of the situation, Brexit negotiations could be extended. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The number of coronavirus fatalities in Iran has surpassed 54,000. The health ministry has also reported some 190 new daily deaths. The health ministry spokeswoman also reported more than 6,200 new infections in one day. That brings the total caseload to 1,170,000. The official said that nearly 1 million people have managed to recover from the deadly disease. Iranian government implemented COVID restrictions across the nation last month in an effort to curb the pandemic. The number of fatalities and infections has relatively dropped ever since. India has reported its lowest daily number of coronavirus infections in some 6 months, with more than 19,500 new cases. The figure posted Tuesday brings India's total confirmed cases to more than 10 million. Daily infections have been falling steadily there since a peak in September. India has the world's second highest case tally after the U.S. In Taiwan, the first local COVID transmission was reported on Tuesday, and that ends 253 days of being virus-free. Meantime, South Korea has moved to shut down all the ski resorts and winter tourist spots. That's part of restrictions to battle a third wave, mainly affecting the capital Seoul and nearby areas. Gatherings of more than four people will be banned as well. Now, in other news, a poll shows that nearly half of Americans want to get rid of the electoral college system that decides the outcome of U.S. presidential election. A joint economist YouGov survey found that 46% of Americans are in favor of amending the Constitution so that the candidate who received the most votes nationwide wins the election. However, 34% of those polled said that they have no desire to change the system, indicating the Electoral College should remain operable. Now, the survey comes amid disputes over the November presidential vote, with incumbent Donald Trump and his team challenging the election results. Well, these cause some observers to suggest abandoning the Electoral College to certify Democratic candidate Joe Biden's victory over Trump. Biden received 306 electoral votes over Trump's 232. The Yemeni Scholar Association has held a press conference to condemn some Arab states for normalizing their ties with the Tel Aviv regime. The scholars also called any normalization a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause. Our correspondent has a report from Sana'a.
Yemeni scholars came together in the capital Sana'a to condemn some Arab states for normalizing ties with the Israeli regime. They said that with signing normalization deals with Israel, these states have betrayed the Palestinians.
We've announced the continuous processes of normalization of ties with the Zionist entity. We are here to warn other Arab states not to follow the same path. Any normalization deal amounts to the betrayal of the blood of the martyrs who sacrificed their lives to protect the occupied lands against Israeli aggression.
Morocco has been the last Arab state to normalize ties with Israel after Bahrain, the UAE, and Sudan over the past months.
The scholars of Yemen reiterate their opposition to any recognition of the Zionist enemy. We believe that it amounts to betrayal of the Muslim values. This will pave the way for further aggression against the Palestinians.
The normalization deals have already sparked outrage among the public and the Muslim world, where pro-Palestine sentiment runs deep. Meanwhile, Palestinians from all political factions have been unanimous in their condemnation of the normalization deals. They seek an independent state in the West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip with the East Jerusalem Al-Quds as its capital. So the normalization, they say, serves as betrayal of their cause.
Yemeni scholars voiced their support for the Palestinians, warning Arab world to adopt a united stance against Israeli aggression. They say the normalization deals will only embolden Israel to press ahead with its oppressive policies against the Palestinians. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam dear listeners, and we are with you with another episode of this series. This time we are going to discuss the method of Imam Khomeini's behavior with the students of seminaries, especially his system of payment of tuition to them. Stay tuned, please. According to a religious tradition, the students who study in seminaries receive tuition from the sources of emulation in order not to face financial problems. This tuition is paid on the basis of the level of education. This tuition is maintained by the money gathered from almsgiving, mainly in the form of khums and zakat and endowments. Thus, the government has no role in this. That's why the Shia clerical structure has been independent of the ruling system throughout history. Since the early years of the advent of Islam, righteous and pious people have endowed large swathes of properties, including real estates, gardens, farms, factories, shops, etc., to the seminaries so that they could use them for administration of those religious centers. These monies are spent for education, teaching, research, propagation, management, and relevant jobs. Of course, the money paid to the students is not sufficient for an ordinary livelihood. Therefore, the seminary students have to lead a very simple life and forget about many daily requirements, let alone luxurious life. Payment of tuition to the seminary students is based on Ayah 41 of Surah Anfal of the Noble Quran, part of which reads, "And know that whatever you gain, one-fifth of it is for God and for the messenger and for the near of kin and the orphans and the needy and the wayfarer. According to the jurisprudential terms, khums means one-fifth of a person's annual income that should be paid to the Imam of the age and the descendants of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, with special conditions. Of course, during the time of Imam Mahdi's occultation, this money should be paid to sources of emulation. Khums consists of two parts, the share of Imam Mahdi and the share of Sadat or descendants of the Prophet. Half of khums is spent for public usage such as research, teaching, propagation, and promotion of religious sciences, establishment of seminaries, mosques, and helping the poor, calamity-stricken people, and so on. The other half is spent for the poor among the descendants of the Prophet, since it is religiously forbidden or haram to pay them charity or sadaqah. Sources of emulation spend part of the tuition to propagate and promote the religion and another part for training of specialists in religious fields and securing a portion of the students' needs. Of course, this money is not paid to the students and ulama who work in a center affiliated to the government because they are paid by the government. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, was a great source of emulation who was very careful in spending tuition to the students of seminaries. In view of the Imam, being hardworking was a high criterion for payment of tuition. Thus, he used to give exams to volunteers and assign tuition for them as students. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Muhammadi Gilani said on this, after the Imam came to Holy Najaf and started teaching Makaseb at Sheikh Ansari Mosque, he assigned tuition for students. Of course, this was done after giving exam by those who he had appointed. Those who could pass the exam would be accepted to receive the tuition. This examination program would cause the students to study diligently. Paying tuition to those who were qualified was of high importance to Imam Khomeini. Hujjatul Islam Mohsen Saghafi says, if Imam Khomeini realized that a student is interested in religious sciences, he would help him as much as he could, no matter if the student was in Qom or other cities, no matter if he knew him or not. If the Imam understood that the student was not able to make money due to studying, he would assist him in different ways or through his representatives or emulators who gave him money. Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini would react to those students who were not serious and hardworking in education. One of his reactions was to cut their tuition. Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Abdul Hamid Irawani recounts a memory in this regard. Imam Khomeini would choose different methods to encourage students and ulema to learn jurisprudence and attain high degrees. Sometimes, if someone was spending his time lackadaisically, the Imam didn't like to give him tuition. Dear friends, Imam Khomeini believed that paying enough tuition to assiduous students was a way of strengthening seminaries. Therefore, he increased their tuition notably. Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Jafar Karimi says in this regard, one day, Imam Khomeini called me and said, the Baptist government intends to dissolve the Najaf Seminary. Now I consider it as my religious duty to do my best not to let this happen. One of the ways to do this is to embark on the situation of the students and increase their tuition. Hujjatul Islam, Kharaghani also said, when Imam Khomeini came to Najaf, the tuition of students was very unfavorable and most of them were in poverty because the maximum tuition that they received was 2.5 dinars. This was while the rent of a small house in Najaf was almost 2 dinars. As the Imam came, the first tuition that he assigned was 3 dinars. The next month, it increased to 6 dinars and later on it became 30 dinars. Dear friends, Imam Khomeini used to ask about the condition of students, and if he was informed of a poor student, it would surely help him. Hujjatul Islam Muhammad Ibrahim Ansari Anaraki says in this regard, the Imam was heedful of students, especially the young ones, and would inquire about their situation constantly. If they were needy, he would pay special attention to them. Although he was under pressure by the regime and Savak, the Shah regime wouldn't allow people's money to reach the Imam, yet he would do his best to help students. Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, frauds and cheaters. Those who find their happiness in misfortunes of others and their profit in loss of others are neither humans nor true Muslims. They lack that social character which gives man superiority over other creatures. Losses can be inflicted openly or may be hidden through frauds and tricks and other forms of dishonesty. Islam forbids these. Remember, brothers and sisters, Islam is a lifestyle. It forbids these types of tricks and tactics. Whatever the form may be, as is apparent from the disgust expressed in the saying of Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam. The Imam says, one who defrauds or causes a loss to a Muslim or tricks him does not belong to us. Over here, and many other traditions which talk about, you know, they don't belong to us, over here it means that they are not from among the Muslims. They are not the part of the Muslim Ummah. So brothers and sisters, fraud and cheating and playing all these tricks and tactics to deceive others, this is something that is condemned in Islam. Islam does not appreciate that sort of attitude and that sort of approach. Unfortunately, the world we live in, we see that those who do fraud and those who cheat others, they get to climb up the ladder in many cases. But rest assured, Islam is not endorsing any of those tactics and any of those strategies that are based on deception, lies, fraud, and cheat. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the frauds and the cheaters. We don't like them. We all unanimously say we don't like to be cheated upon. Now, cheating and deception are despicable characteristics that are beneath a decent person. Intentionally distorting the truth in order to mislead others contradicts the values of honesty, which requires an attitude of sincerity, straightforwardness, and fairness that leaves no room for cheating. There's no room for lying. There's no room for trickery or deceit. There are many texts from the Quran and the Sunnah of the Holy Prophet and infallible Imams conveying the meaning that cheating, whether the target be Muslims or non-Muslims, is forbidden. Accepting the guidance of Islam leads a person to truthfulness, which means a person completely avoids cheating and backstabbing. A lot of times, especially when it comes to the Muslim youth, they tend to think that it's okay to deceive the non-Muslims just because they're not Muslims. When it comes to Muslims, they understand these concepts, but when it comes to non-Muslims, for some reason, they come to a conclusion that it's okay to deceive them, it's okay to trick them. Guess what, brothers and sisters? Islam does not allow you to be unfair with a non-Muslim either. Islam wants you to be careful in your attitude, whether it is towards a Muslim or it is towards a non-Muslim. Now, of course, there's a small little point that you need to keep in mind, and that is the non-Muslims who are at war with Islam and Muslims. Those are known as kuffar, kuffar-e harbi, and those non-Muslims who are at war with Islam and Muslims, that is an exception to the case. Other than that, all non-Muslims are supposed to be treated with fairness. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
the limelight.
In the midst of the greatest health emergency in modern times, with more than 4 million surgical procedures delayed by the National Health Service, Britain has announced a record increase of £16.5 billion in so-called defense spending. But these billions are not for defense. Britain has no enemies other than those within who betray the trust of its ordinary people, its nurses and doctors, its carers, elderly, homeless, and youth, as successive neoliberal governments have done. Conservative and Labour, says John Pilger, journalist and writer, in an article published under the heading, "The most lethal virus is not COVID, it is war." Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Britain's Armed Services Memorial is a silent hunting place. Set in the rural beauty of Staffordshire in an arboretum of some 30,000 trees and sweeping lawns, its Homeric figures celebrate determination and sacrifice. The names of more than 16,000 British servicemen and women are listed. The literature says they died in operational theater or war targeted by terrorists. Malaya, Ireland, Kenya, Hong Kong, Libya, Iraq, Palestine, and many more, including secret operations such as Indochina. Not a year has passed since peace was declared in 1945 that Britain has not sent military forces to fight the wars of empire. Not a year has passed when countries mostly poor and riven by conflict have not bought or have been soft-loaned British arms to further the wars or interests of empire. Empire? What empire? The investigative journalist Phil Miller recently revealed in Declassified that Boris Johnson's Britain maintained 145 military sites, called them bases, in 42 countries. Johnson has boasted that Britain is to be the foremost naval power in Europe. In the midst of the greatest health emergency in modern times, with more than 4 million surgical procedures delayed by the National Health Service, Johnson has announced a record increase of £16.5 billion in so-called defense spending, a figure that would restore the under-resourced NHS many times over. But these billions are not for defense. Britain has no enemies other than those within who betray the trust of its ordinary people, its nurses and doctors, its carers, elderly, homeless, and youth, as successive neoliberal governments have done, Conservative and Labour. Pilger said, "Exploring the security of the National War Memorial, I soon realized there was not a single monument or plinth or plaque or rosebush honoring the memory of Britain's victims, the civilians in the peacetime operations commemorated here. There is no remembrance of the Libyans killed when their country was willfully destroyed by Prime Minister David Cameron and his collaborators in Paris and Washington. There is no word of regret for the Serbian women and children killed by British bombs, dropped from a safe height on schools, factories, bridges, towns, on the orders of Tony Blair, or for the impoverished Yemeni children extinguished by Saudi regime pilots, with their logistics and targets supplied by Britons in the air-conditioned safety of Riyadh, or for the Syrians starved by sanctions. There is no monument to the Palestinian children murdered with the British elite's enduring connivance, such as the recent campaign that destroyed a modest reform movement within the Labour Party with the specious accusations of anti-Semitism. 2 weeks ago, the Zionist regime's military chief of staff and Britain's chief of the defense staff signed an agreement to formalize and enhance military cooperation. This was not new. More British arms and logistical support will now flow to the fake and lawless regime in Tel Aviv, whose snipers target children and psychopaths interrogate children in extreme isolation. Perhaps the most striking omission at the Staffordshire War Memorial is an acknowledgement of the million Iraqis whose lives and country were destroyed by the illegal invasion of Blair and Bush in 2003. ORB, a member of the British Polling Council, put the figure at 1.2 million. In 2013, the Comrades organization asked a cross-section of the British public how many Iraqis had died in the invasion. A majority said fewer than 10,000. Such a lethal silence sustained in a sophisticated society? The answer is that propaganda is far more effective in societies that regard themselves as free than in dictatorships and autocracies, include censorship by omission. Western propaganda industries, both political and cultural, including most of the media, are the most powerful and refined on earth. Big lies can be repeated incessantly in comforting BBC Voices. Omissions are no problem. A similar question relates to nuclear war, whose threat is of no interest, to quote Harold Pinter. In South Korea, a missile system known as Terminal High Altitude Air Defense, or THAAD, is aimed point blank at China across the narrow East China Sea. Russia, a nuclear power, is encircled by the war-making group known as NATO, with British troops regularly maneuvering right up to the border where Hitler invaded. Pilger said, "A few years after the invasion of Iraq, I made a film called The War You Don't See, in which I asked leading American and British journalists, as well as TV news executives, people I knew as colleagues, why and how Bush and Blair were allowed to get away with the great crime in Iraq, considering that the lies were not very clever. Their response surprised me. Had we, they said, that is journalists and broadcasters, especially in the US, challenged the claims of the White House and Downing Street, investigated and exposed the lies, instead of amplifying and echoing them, the invasion of Iraq in 2003 probably would not have happened. Countless people would be alive today, for a million refugees would not have fled. The grisly Daesh, a product of the Blair Bush invasion, might not have been conceived." David Rose, then, with the London Observer, which supported the invasion, described the peak of lies fed to me by a fairly sophisticated disinformation campaign. Raghe Umar, then, the BBC's man in Iraq, told me we failed to press the most uncomfortable buttons hard enough. Dan Rather, the CBS anchorman, agreed, as did many others. I admired these journalists who broke the silence, but they are honorable exceptions. Today, the war drums have new and highly enthusiastic beaters in Britain, America, and the Western world. COVID has provided cover for this pandemic of propaganda. In July, Morrison took his cue from Trump and announced that Australia, which has no enemies, would spend $270 billion on provoking one, including missiles that could reach China. The Australian media cheered almost as one, delivering a shower of abuse at China. Thousands of Chinese students who had guaranteed the gross salaries of Australian vice chancellors were advised by the government to go elsewhere. Colonial racism is never hard to revive. In a part of the article, Pilger added, Some years ago, I interviewed the former head of the CIA in Latin America, Duane Clarage. In a few refreshingly honest words, he summed up Western foreign policy as it is ordained and directed by Washington. The superpower, he said, could do what it wanted, where it wanted, whenever its strategic interests dictated. His words were, "Get used to it, world." I have reported a number of wars. I have seen the remains of children and women and the elderly bombed and burned to death. Their villages laid to waste. Their petrified trees festooned with human parts and much else. Perhaps that is why I reserve a specific contempt for those who promote the crime of rapacious war, who beckon it with bad faith and profanities, having never experienced it themselves. Their monopoly must be broken.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kHz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
www.parstoday.com/en. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 12, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participants at the joint graduation ceremony held at the Imam Ali Military Academy.
In order to employ logic for the sake of measuring our defensive power, we should see threats the way they are. Enemies conceal their threats in order to launch a surprise attack, and sometimes They magnify the size of threats in order to intimidate nations all over the world. The latter is done by most superpowers. They portray their threats and their powers with more glowing terms in order to force others into retreat. If you can see the real size of the threats, if a nation, country, armed force, and leaders and commanders in that armed force manage to see the correct measures of a threat, and if on the other hand, they see their true capacities, power, and talents, and they succeed in calculating them in the right way, and then organize and deploy them, against them make ready your strength to the utmost of your power, the Holy Quran, chapter 8, verse 60, and finally, if they manage to see the enemy's real threats, then national interests will surely be ensured, and national assets and identity will be preserved.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
If a nation has the defensive power to carry out such a calculation, then politicians and the people in that country feel calm and tranquil, and they will engage in carrying out the duties that are necessary in every country. Therefore, defensive power plays such a role. As I said, rationality means making the correct calculations. We should carry out correct calculations and have a healthy calculation system. This is what rationality means. However, when some people mention reason and rationality, they actually mean feeling afraid. When they say be reasonable, it means be afraid and passive. It means that we should run away in the face of the enemy. This should not be the case. Cowards do not have the right to speak of rationality.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.